Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Greetings, comrades, and today I have a treat for you. It's a special one. I haven't been speaking about our independence struggles before in the age of Atmoda, reawakening, but right now I'm interviewing a person who was directly involved in these events straight from the top up. A person who was personally voting for independence and then, you know, very responsible for running the country in the early years. Mr. Edmunds Krastinch. So, hello, Edmunds.
Hello.
It's an honor to be here. And the first question is, so, we all know about, like, all the hopes and dreams that every common Latvian had at the time, that, you know, we wanted our own independence, but we really didn't know what independence actually looked like and what capitalism was. You were in our higher council, so I guess you must have had some view on what's going to happen next. What were you thinking would happen after we had gained independence? And also, well, if you could, in short, explain how you managed to get in this voting organ, this higher council.
Yeah, it's all started, I think, gradually with Gorbachev's glasnost policy. And glasnost policy actually started from that Gorbachev could not successfully realize economic reforms. Here was quite resistance in higher echelons of Soviet Union, and instead of this, he went some way which he called glasnost or democratization, so that a little bit of press freedom was allowed, and so people started to try what is now this barrier, how far you can go, what you can tell. It started first from Moscow, and then in Baltic republics, people feeling that now it's a little bit more free, they started to talk, started different initiatives. They started to talk about independence before 1940, and it started around 1987, when first independent Latvia flags you could see on streets. And then, after 1 year, here came idea. Possibly it was initiated by some communist party ideologues to involve people into this democratization process, which they wanted to control and move in a direction which they thought they would like to move Soviet Union. To found such an organization as People's Front. So at summer of 1988, here started to pop up kind of initiative groups in all places in Latvia. And I was working outside of Riga, some 120 kilometers to north, closer to border with Estonia. I was programmer, computer scientist in one town, and Already before, I was interested in different political things and history, but I didn't like all this Communist Party ideology and how they controlled things and limited things and didn't allow people to do everything. And I felt that I have to make this People's Front initiative group in my workplace. So I did this, I organized this, and then some way people choose me to go to this founding congress of People's Front. I went here, and at that time I changed my workplace. I started postgraduate studies, and I had more free time. And in 1989, I was partly postgraduate studies, and partly I was like this new movement's political activist. I organized things. First, we went for municipal elections in 1989, won these elections. I was elected in district council as a member of this council. And then came, in 1990, came elections to Supreme Council, which was in formal Soviet structure, highest legislative organ in Soviet Latvia, of course.
Yeah, another question about that. Were there any campaigns, like you had your People's Movement, and then there were the Communist Party. Were there any campaign slogans? How did the campaigns for that looking like?
Yeah, it was actually first such a time when this campaign, after something like 50, 60 years happened in Latvia, and people didn't have much experience, and still all this interchange with the Western world was quite limited. But of course, People's Front had this campaign. We had flyers. We tried to get our message through mass media, which were not so strictly controlled already, and many people in mass media sympathized to People's Front. But as well, here was a Communist Party, this Latvian part of Communist Party, so to say, Progressive Communist Party. And then this Interfront part, which was strongly conservative communists. And then agriculturists. So it already started to split in different movements. But still, the main question was for independence or against it. And people voted in this way in Latvia. If you said that you are for independence, you could get almost all Latvian support. If you voted against, then you didn't get this support. Maybe you get support from Russians, mm-hmm. or people who came here after occupation, migrants. So, and in some incidental way, I was as well moved to participate in this election against one of the cooperatives director, kolkhoz director.
Wow.
In you know, agricultural region, I was not agriculturist, but I won because I was from People's Front.
Oh, nice. Another thing, I have explained to my listeners already all the story about the Baltic Way and the mass demonstration that happened in Meshparks. But then when it comes to voting itself, what was the feeling in the hall? I guess that's the question that gets asked to everyone who voted that day. But did you was there any debate? Were there arguments? How did the whole process of voting for independence go down? Like, what was the feeling back then?
You mean in Supreme Council?
Yeah, yeah.
In Supreme Council, it was mainly speeches about from one side and from another side. Of course, People's Front told that we how to vote for this, but it was still not full. We understood that it's not full independence. It was still Soviet Union, and the situation was quite unclear. It was like a declaration for independence, for or will to be independent. But still, we explained everything why we want this, that we were independent country before 1940 when Latvia was occupied, and that we want to be independent and go our own way. And those who were against, mostly communists, They explained that they want to stay in Soviet Union, it will be better, it's big country, big market, you know, if we speak about economics and what such a small Latvia could do outside of big, you know, Soviet Union, which will now will develop very, very successfully, as they thought. So this was an issue, how to do this. And after we voted, it was not real independence. It was still for more than 1 year, it was kind of two governments in Latvia. Our local government, which controlled part of things, and still control from Moscow, from Soviet Union structures and organizations. And this continued till 1991 August, when this putsch in Moscow was done and when Yeltsin won.
So it was in Moscow when Yeltsin finally signed the document, which was, how was it, the formation of the SNG countries, I suppose, independent nation states, which dissolved the Soviet Union. That's the official date when we should actually celebrate.
Yeah, yeah.
But we do celebrate it here on the 4th of May, just because you voted, and I guess.
Yeah,
everyone who voted yes on that day is, you know, a national hero. That is why I'm very, very happy to be here. But it was fine. But then, you know, and yeah, I've also watched the. There's a movie called Ceturtā Maija Republika, of course, because I'm a historian. And then there's this whole story when I was very young about like the crazy 90s and how privatization happened and how everything went rampant. And I had kind of tried to explain to people that it was because a lot of people didn't even know how this whole capitalism system worked. And at one point, you must have gotten involved. You later on went to be our Minister of Finances, too, here in Latvia. So How was it like to try to control this whole mess which suddenly appeared? Like all these random kolkhozes building up a corporation, some criminal activity going here and there. Like you were in a position of power. How do you operate politically in such a chaos? And how do you evaluate how well did you do?
Here was after we gained real independence 1991 in September. Here was some interim period when still the Supreme Council operated. It was 92 and till mid of 93. And what we did as a parliament, we tried to make a framework where economy could operate and where everything could operate. We started to make new laws, which are needed for market economy to function. Like we renewed civil code, because in Soviet times here was not such a civil code, because private property was almost non-existent. Commercial code, everything was from a scratch. So actually 1.5 years parliament just worked making those this framework where economy could operate. And telling people that just start your business, try to find what you can do. Especially after we introduced our own currency in 92, here was real cut of links with former Soviet Union, because then our money started to appreciate because we controlled inflation, but in the Soviet Union money was still, you know, emitted lot, and here was high inflation. From one side, from another side, in Soviet Union, prices were not real. You got supplies from somewhere, metal or oil, by some artificial prices. And now everybody started to charge real prices. That was a real shock for industry which operated in Latvia. So quick privatization was needed, because government could not control 1,000 industrial companies, which actually most of them were made to work for Soviet Union market. Here were factories which produced just military equipment.
Yeah, I've read in the archives that Latvia and Baltics in general were among the donor countries for the whole Soviet Union, that up to 16% of our GDP went away to support other Soviet republics, and that's not even counting how much we actually spent on supplying the unnecessary army bases here. So I don't know. There is a myth that that's very widespread, even among Russians whom I consider my friends. We have one. He doesn't listen to the podcast though. But hello, Nick. he basically holds to this opinion that, you know, that the Soviet Union like built all this industry up here for Latvia, so it kind of helped us develop and gave us all these workplaces, and that during this kind of gaining independence period, that we tore all of this down. The same view, by the way, is held by a lot of our own sort of, I say, ultra far right wing people, who kind of mourn the loss of VEF, I think, and Rīgas Radio Rūpnīca. I don't even know. But yeah, they made military parts for military things, I think. And like I've heard stories that, for example, in Valmiera, where we had this meat producing plant, which made sausages and packed meats, that even though the meat was like produced and made right there in these products, the people just didn't even see the products. They were just shipped away already. So yeah, what was the situation with all this industry? And how would you answer to these people who say that, look, Soviet Union built all this stuff up for you? Well, did we actually benefit from this? Because according to pure statistic data, and that's Soviet statistics, which I looked up in the archives, 16%, like almost one-sixth of our economy, everything our economy produced, was sent to support other republics. And of the remaining part, about 20% went to support the Soviet army. So it's like 36% of our total GDP went for, you know, people who weren't citizens of Latvia, who had actually nothing to do with our own things, really. From the economical perspective, that is, at least.
Yeah, it's not so simple thing. People like to simplify to make their cases more persuasive. In every centralized country, you have some distribution mechanisms from places which are richer to places which are poorer. Of course, Baltic republics were richer places in Soviet Union, so here should be some distribution like to Central Asia, where people were much, much poorer. And of course, Soviet Union was a highly militarized country, so it's because of Cold War. That was a bad thing, but that was it. Every part of Soviet Union paid this, how to say, part of their GDP for military, for this paranoidical sense of that you are like fortress, you have to defend yourself.
So that our listeners wouldn't bomb us, because I have to know that according to, like, I have this survey, and a lot of our listeners are military or ex-military, so hey.
No, but you know, you can understand this. They can bomb us. We want to, you know, counter. But this paranoia was so far that, as you know, all the seashore of Latvia was inaccessible for common people. Only with permits you can travel here, because here was such a paranoia that, you know, some people from outside of Latvia, some capitalists will come, you know, make a propaganda, spoil or minds of builders of communism. Then about industry. If Latvia would continue to be independent country after war, Second World War, and trade with other nations freely and free market way, we would build different factories. We would not build such a factories which were built in Soviet times. Those factories were built not for Latvia, but for Soviet Union, for needs of Soviet Union, like VEF or Radiotechnica or commutators, who made highly needed electronical equipment for Soviet needs. When Soviet Union ceased to exist, nobody wanted this, those electronics. Nobody needed them. And maybe some, you know, consumer goods, which were made in VEF, like radio receivers, amplifiers, etc., they were much poorer quality than what was made in Japan, for example. So they were not competitive. That was the reason why largest part of this industry ceased to exist after breakup of Soviet Union, because it existed only for Soviet Union needs with distorted prices. Of course, you could solve this, for example, this problem with meat products, which were sent. Just make a right price, balance supply and demand. But Gorbachev didn't want to go for this. He wanted to control prices to for people to be happy with low prices. And in result, you got empty shelves.
Yeah. About Gorbachev, I also, in my childhood, I was often told that Gorbachev, by allowing for all of this to happen, that he was somehow a good guy. But then I grew up and learned about both Chernobyl and like what happened in Vilnius. And it's like, well, Gorbachev was an idealist in my mind. I think he really believed in communism, and I had read his book, which was really interesting. It was called Perestroika and the New Communist Way of Thinking. It was in Latvian, printed in 1987, I presume, where he nicely speaks, like a whole chapter is devoted to how the Soviet Union shall try to cooperate with America, but how, like, for example, the separation of Germany is now a solid fact, which will go into the 21st century. These aspects change a lot, but Gorbachev, I don't know. I would state that Gorbachev was, in a way, the most kind of democratic leader that Soviet Russia, and let's increase this a bit, up to this day, to modern Russia, ever had. Because I think Yeltsin was not much of a leader at all. Well, except his early years, but all this shift kind of started. So what are your opinions on Gorbachev? Maybe I'm wrong here, but it's just...
No,
my opinions are complicated on him.
We are happy that... Communist Party of Soviet Union choose him as a leader after Brezhnev stagnation period and two short-living leaders of Communist Party, because he started processes which he could not control later and which gave us independence. Could he be more successful in sense that to keep Soviet Union together and go some kind of China way, modernizing economy and making better living conditions? I'm not sure. I cannot see how to do this in Russia, taking into consideration what is now going on in Russia. Russia is not China, and I think what we got was for Latvia best outcome possible. But he was not much of a Democrat, of course.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly better than Mr. Putin here. And this is a question, just let's move a bit away from history. I want to ask you about modern Russia right now, because I watch a lot of Russian economical channels, like on YouTube. Like I follow Stepan Demura and Dmitry Potapenko. You might have heard of these names. The kind of Russian opposition economists and Russian businessmen who speak out about their problems, and Dmitry Prunko, but about their issues, a lot of people say that right now Russia is going through something like a stagnation period, where basically they're trying to... Well, their latest statement was "Люди новая нефть," or "The people are the new oil," which was kind of meant by the leader of Rosnano in the sense that we shouldn't be investing in oil, we should be building up our people. But everyone in Russia understood that, okay, you know, oil money is running out, time to, you know, start to take money from the people. But that's some black humor story. I would just like if you could comment on the economical situation, as far as you know, at least, in Russia, as with their strictly export-based raw resource economy with the Soviet Union, because a lot of Russian opposition journalists and economists draw these parallels. So are there any, or is Putin more like a Stalin figure instead of like a Brezhnev-Khrushchev figure who's like stagnating?
Russia is now, I think, quite different from Soviet Union. Maybe not fully functional, but here is market economy. Here is private property. Here is some much higher level of freedom, press freedom. You can go outside from Russia. You can, if somebody gives you a visa to United States or UK, you can go freely. In Soviet Union, you could not do this without acceptance of Communist Party. So Russia is very different from Soviet Union. It's a totally different country, and I'm not a big specialist on the economy of Russia, but if oil price is going up, then Russian economy is going better, is okay. Doing better. So how far, I don't know. But I don't see any big success as well, that they are modernizing or becoming more independent of oil. No, they're just the same economies, the same oil dependent, raw materials dependent. So.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Well, another question. You used to be our Minister of Finances for a while in Latvia. And that's a question that has arrived because I posted on Twitter that I'll be interviewing you, and some people actually like wrote to me and asked. So one of the questions is, what does a Minister of Finances actually do? This comes from a libertarian listener who thinks there should be a very small government, but what do you actually did as a minister? I'm sorry, but you know, as a breather from all these historical themes, I kind of want to ask you maybe some of these more lighthearted questions, but they're important too, after all, because we're used to looking at politicians as these people from the outside who run things, so nobody knows what you're actually up to.
Yeah, mainly it's time spent in different committees discussing things. And then, you know, signing different documents where minister's signature is needed, like sending a budget to parliament.
Oh, so you were...
This is one of the most important things Minister of Finance does. Signs state government budget and sends to parliament, and then tries to defend in parliament.
Oh, but you also come up in the committees with the whole budget, right?
Yeah, with budget and all... other things which supplement, yeah. Like changes in taxes and
the hardest
part is to defend the budget in parliament if you don't have enough members of parliament in support of you, if here is a strong opposition. Budget is made by the people from departments and from other ministries, so minister cannot, you know, go into much of details. He can know framework, what is economy, how much of taxes we will get next year, and how much we can spend, how big deficit could be, or no deficit, and then in general, how much we spend on health, how much we spend on military, and etc., etc. And then here always are demands, you know, and teachers are demanding that wages have to be increased, and doctors are demanding that wages have to be increased, etc.
Yeah, that is one thing that I've, it's also a major theme of my podcast, that I always try to explain how, you know, how Soviet Union, in the name, like how my father named it, was a whole, like a big, whole prison, just a gigantic prison, and that even though we escaped the prison, we couldn't lose the prison in our heads. Because, as I've mentioned previously in the show, it was often the case that my parents wanted me to grow up in this Atmoda era to become a nice, like a good person, enjoy capitalism. But they never kind of pushed me to start my own business. I did it on my own with my podcast, and I can't even call that a business. It's something that I just do for listeners, and I'm very happy that I'm making some money out of it. But it's more of a science work, I'd say. But the problem is that still up until today, making your own business, which is a crucial part of the economy, at least here in Latvia, and not only in Latvia, in Eastern Europe in general, and I'm adding Eastern Europe as in post-Soviet bloc countries, here, being a businessman due to the early 90s is seen like something that's very risky, something that you shouldn't be maybe doing. Only in like very few latter years, 2-3 years, I've actually seen more advertisements, for example, for people to study business. But a lot of families here still hold on to the fact that you should, you know, someone should become an engineer or a doctor so that they would become an employee for someone, for the government or something. Why so? Why don't we have more entrepreneurs? What would you say about this? Because I think it's some sort of post-Soviet thinking where in a lot of families still, even 25 years, more than 25 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, we still haven't, I don't know, westernized in the sense that we need more businessmen taking responsibility. This is kind of, at least, that's the biggest issue that the Soviet Union has left us. How would you look at this? The fact that not enough people do make their own companies right now, that we're, I think, at least not using our own full potential.
Yeah, one is fear of doing this. They don't have experience. If you don't have a lot of businessmen, so you don't have a lot of children who are growing up in this environment. They don't know what does it mean. And then, of course, here is a higher barrier to enter this world if you don't know about it. I hope it will improve in future, but sure, it's post-Soviet heritage, and one generation cannot change it totally, so it is.
I guess I'm going to have to raise my own kids a bit differently. Like, yeah, maybe. If another question, can you tell me your favorite political Soviet anecdote? You can tell it in Russian and I'll just translate it to you.
I can immediately recall this one. You know, in Soviet time, in Brezhnev's time, policemen sees on Red Square two older women who are looking around for something. He asks, what you are looking for? We are looking for principle. What is principle? This shop which Comrade Brezhnev told us that in principle we have everything.
Well, thank you. That was actually a great one. Thank you both for being in our show and for helping our independence and for, you know, running our country for a while. Thank you very much, Mr. Krestic.
Happy to do this.
Okay, thank you, comrades, and I hope you enjoyed this interview. And next episode, we are going to move on Stalin's history, I think, or maybe some, you know, tales, because I have accumulated some about how it's like to work in a telephone service and how actually all sorts of public services, just plumbing and industry, work in the Soviet Union. Haven't decided yet, but it's one of these two. До свидания, товарищи.
Thank you for listening to The Eastern Border. If you have any comments or specific details you'd like to know, you're welcome to leave it in the comment section on our site, theeasternborder.lv, and we'll rummage even to the western border to find you an answer. Like this podcast? Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or on our RSS feed. Happiness is mandatory. Good reviews and donations feed the farmers of our kolkhoz in the great motherland. The Eastern Border salutes you. This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org for more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.